is a presentation of the Match Talk Podcast Network.
Hello, wrestling fans. It's time for the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. The World Wrestling Resource was made that you as a wrestler, parent, coach, or fan can have access to all the resources of the very best in the world of wrestling. I'm three-time wrestling writer and broadcaster of the year, Jason Bryant, and I want you to join me, along with John McGovern and world champions Terry Brands and Dennis Hall, as we talk training tips, topical discussion, mental preparation, and more on the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. World Wrestling Resource is sponsored by Defense Soap. Find World Wrestling Resource on Facebook at facebook.com/World Wrestling Resource and follow us on Twitter at WWRESO and, of course, on the web at worldwrestlingresource.com. Now on to the show as we join John McGovern, Terry Brands, and Dennis Hall. Episode 42 of the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. Jason Bryant here with you, joined today by John McGovern. John has been a busy, busy man here as the close of the Division III wrestling season. And now, I wouldn't say exactly an international traveler, because for us in the United States, Canada is not really super international. But John, you and your squad getting back from a trip up to Canada. We talked to Doug Cox on our previous episode about that trip. And let's just get some recaps from you on what was it like taking your boys up to Guelph.
Well, it's a great experience for them, and, you know, they have guys that are all ages. They had kids that are training for Pan Ams at the junior level, and then they got, you know, Corey Jarvis, who was eighth in the Olympics, still training, you know, for another set of Olympics. I think he's, what, 30, in his 30s, heavyweight wrestler. And so they got to train with, you know, a variety of different styles and looks, and Coach Cox was very helpful, and he showed some stuff to my guys, and they got some good exposure. So, yeah, like you said, it's a short trip, only about, you know, 12, 14 hours, depending on how fast you drive. But we crossed the Detroit bridge there. It's not a far drive, so we plan on going up there again. I know my grad assistant's going to compete up there at their tournament in July, and looks like we might set up an exchange with them down the road. So it was a good experience for our guys, for sure.
Yeah, what was it? Was it mainly freestyle training there, or was it just an amalgam of the various styles of wrestling that you and Coach Cox brought to the table?
Yeah. So yeah, Doug's you know, he's a Greco and a freestyle Olympian, like you said, and we did a few you know, training sets in Greco, but he kind of admitted that they're mostly a freestyle nation. They're not really good worldwide in Greco, and so. The focus was more on freestyle for the competition and the training. I think that's kind of more what they focused too on their college level scene. And it was kind of interesting just hearing him, you know, how he goes about recruiting. And I was kind of asking him too, why he didn't look at Michigan and some of the recruiting, you know, in the U.S. And so when we kind of started talking about financial aid and costs there, he kind of opened his eyes to maybe, you know, recruiting in the U.S., which maybe isn't good for our colleges, but it's good for our wrestlers and giving them opportunities. So, I think it's a great option for American wrestlers if they want to, you know, train freestyle while in college, but they're still Americans, right? So they can come back to America and compete.
Yeah, I know that Winnipeg, which unfortunately announced they were just dropping their program, actually has a kid from Oklahoma named Finn Higgins, who has been a national champion at what is now called the U Sport, which used to be called the CIS. So there are a couple of Yanks up there competing. Now, when you look at this from a coaching standpoint, what do you pick up at this point in your career from a guy like Doug Cox that you can bring into your wrestling room and teach on the folk-style mats at Dubuque?
Well, I mean, technically he showed some good stuff. I mean, he's definitely got some unique styles for how he clears underhooks and what he uses, and some of our guys are using it right away, and our staff's really excited about some of that stuff. But just from an overall, you know, philosophy was, you know, making sure that the room's open, you know, pretty much year-round for the guys, and meeting the needs of your committed wrestlers, but also the lesser committed, and, you know, giving them opportunities to grow in the sport and take them to the levels they're at, and you know, knowing what levels they're capable of with their skill level to be competing in, so they're sending them to the, you know, right kind of competitions that they're ready for. But you know, he utilizes his staff. He had an assistant, I think it's from Hungary originally, right? And he was a he wrestled Daniel Igali. I think he lost to him in the qualifier, but I think he had a win over him. And what, Igali was the Olympic medalist, right, that beat McRaevy. So his assistant is pretty solid, and he had a good staff. And I know with his wrestlers over the summer, they were looking at bringing in like Cuba for after their tournament in July, and going to have a training camp there and maybe Hungary. And so, you know, bringing in some international exposure to his guys because he's, you know, got some of the funding for that. But giving his wrestlers exposure to international wrestling within their training set. So it's a little bit, it felt a little bit like almost like an Olympic training center or a regional training center, but that actually is your program, right? That's their college program. It's the regional training center. It is freestyle and it's year round. And so it kind of makes sense why Americans are doing regional training centers, obviously for the off season training, but I'm bringing in those high level guys. So you got your college guys training with guys that have been training in the sport, honing their craft for 20, 30 years, and they're 30 or 40 years old, still competing and still motivated. So it's a great environment, and we'll probably be back up there for sure.
What did you know about the notice about the women's programs and how their athletes, how they train with them? Did you have any interaction with their athletes?
Yeah, their women wrestlers were wrestling our college guys, and it kind of opened up my guys because they were tough, and you know, they do the same training, same program, and so their skill levels were high, and it was impressive. I mean, to see that. I mean, if you take somebody that's motivated and has that internal drive, they're gonna be very, very good at their craft. And yeah, that was fun for my guys to see that exposure to the women's side of it, and see that, you know, if you're motivated, you can be excellent.
Any of your kids sit there that may have been freestyle inexperienced to be like, hey, coach, man, where was it? You can do that? I mean, did you see any of your guys really get excited about potentially opening doors to wrestling outside of the college season?
My wrestlers were, I mean, a couple of them were talking about then competing, even coming back there to compete and doing freestyle Greco. But I took one of them had a little more experience in Greco and freestyle, so he had been doing that. So it definitely did open their eyes, I think, too, because when, you know, they're thinking it's, you know, when it's Canada, even though it's pretty close by, they're thinking, wow, international. And I think it's good for the kids to think global in their imagination and thinking, hey, you know, I want to be a world champion, an Olympic champion, just as a dream, right? Just like you got kids thinking from Major League Baseball, playing pro ball, you want your wrestlers dreaming big at that age because there's still time to develop.
Now, shifting gears a little bit to your role as a Division III coach, the season is over. The school year is essentially over. Now, for those who are unfamiliar, what is the amount of contact that a coach can have with their athletes? Say it's a winter sport. I mean, how much can you be working with your guys, or what are the rules and stipulations that say if they want extra workouts, what do they have to do?
Well, our certified strength coach can give them strength programs to use over the summer, and then they can be involved in your summer camps. And this is where, you know, programs are, you know, trying to get a lot of, you know, we're trying to set up a 30-day intensive camp, and we've got a lot of camps that we're working on for our guys as much as we are for, you know, the recruiting aspect and the training. So just the summer camps are a great way for your guys to have opportunities to train. But we don't have, like, at this point, for us at least, we don't have a regional training center. So, but when we go to Canada or international trips, those are opportunities to train, and it allows us to have a training camp prior to that. And then I think Nate Hansen at Simpson is going on an international tour for Division III wrestling overseas here, maybe in the next few days. But that's another thing that kind of my guys are talking about going to Canada. We're like, well, we want to maybe look into that trip next year and keep adding, you know, opportunities to travel and wrestle in the world.
Yeah, we'll have to get Nate on the next show, if not that, or the Division III show. We can talk about that quite a bit because, you know, a lot of the wrestling in Division III centers around the Iowa Conference and the teams within the state of Iowa anyway. So that'd be an interesting topic. Just plant that in your brain, listeners, as we can talk about that international tour, which has gone on for a number of years. But as we swing back and we talk about the camps, you bring that up. And I'm curious that on your opinion of how the shift is in competition. Now we're seeing a lot of these tournaments pop up. We got duels tournaments all over the place. We got obviously the Fargo in late July. How much of the more competitive tournaments that have popped up impacted coaches who run wrestling camps, do you see that there's kids still coming in the same amount, or have the tournaments impacted attendance at such camps?
Yeah, that's a great point. So, yeah, I mean, some of these camps, I mean, I'll have camps in June that some of the coaches are saying that they're having training camps to prepare for the Fargo training camp. So the Fargo event itself is a big, you know, motivating factor for a lot of the elite wrestlers in the summer for their training and coaches. But there's always room. Like if you have a camp during Fargo, you know that you're getting the development wrestler, and he's probably, you know, maybe looking to emphasize his technique and development. But, you know, there's room even then early on for intensive training camps for the guys that have technique but want to build more mental toughness and strength. But we try to steer around Fargo if we can, but for camps. But there's always a need for camps and developing wrestlers in the summer, maybe giving them different looks and getting them just away and kind of from their program and just to get a little cross train and just increase their internal drive just by getting away, just like we did to Canada, right? Just get them in a different scenery and then get them back motivated and fresh for their season ahead when they come back to their programs.
Now, as it relates to the World Wrestling Resource, what things are on the burner for World Wrestling Resource and all these things you can find at worldwrestlingresource.com this coming summer?
Well, we're doing Dennis and I are doing the camp in the Dells, and we're getting a lot of teams for June 19th to 22nd, and we're bringing in league camp, world champ, Ben Peterson, Olympic gold medalist, Kevin Jackson, Olympic gold medalist, and Doug Schwab. Good intensity, but really a camp for kids to get and teams to build their program, get matches, get feedback, get technique, get analysis, and just kind of just increase that internal drive for guys in the program. And then I think with Dennis and Terry, we're looking at getting a little bit more of some technique under our website and adding even like some international. Corey Jarvis was showing some of the stuff that he's using as Olympic heavyweight. He said we could add some of that stuff. So just for our users, some of that stuff will be on the website.
Yeah, well, one thing also, you put it in the Dells, and it's not just the team building. It's, oh, wait, water slides everywhere.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor for teams that want to come and experience that, for sure.
Yeah, because you can't just put a camp out in the middle of a wrestling gym and be like, all right, here we are for a week. No, well, that's one thing, too, and as involves the camp system. You got to go to destinations and places for people who don't know in the Midwest here in the United States. Wisconsin Dells is a destination because of the sheer number of water slides in that city.
Yeah, and it matches, right? So you got your highly motivated kids on your team, but you have a lot of kids on your team that are their skill level experience and maybe commitment level isn't as high, and you want to develop your whole team. So that's kind of the idea is, yeah, you can have the highest level commitment with working with Olympic gold medalists, but at the same time, your least committed kid, you can encourage him to stay involved in the sport over the summer with those water parks. So it kind of helps everyone get their team and their whole team, right? Not just their most committed guys to the camp.
One thing that we were looking to do, and John had sent me some questions that while I was in Europe at the European Championships in Novi Sad, Serbia, was to track down some members of the UWW board and get their feelings on a number of questions. We were trying to get one. I actually ended up getting Nenad Lalovic for the Short Time Wrestling podcast, but we were trying to get to Natalia Yarigina, which is the widow of the great Ivan Yarigin, on the show. She actually left before we had the chance to set that interview up. But John, when you were constructing these questions, why do you think it's important that a lot of the focal points of the questions, and we'll get to those here in a bit, are centering around women's wrestling and gender equity and diversity?
Yeah, well, that's great question. So probably you have the answer. You know, that's where the growth of the sport can happen, and we can increase a big part of our fan base. And it's very a sport that we all know helps us so much. Well, why wouldn't we help females as well, right? So, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. What do you feel like? Do you feel like that's something that for the vision for core Olympic sports that helps wrestling maybe on that side, on the political side of things?
Yeah, I think it does. And we're still looking, though, with the role right now. We still have twice as many men's weights as women's weights, even though the styles are different. And I think we've got to get to an IOC point of view where they're looking at maybe adding another discipline for women's wrestling. I think this is where, you know, Mr. Lalovic has pointed out as the potential is as the beach wrestling, as they call it, as becoming a discipline underneath wrestling. And then there could be a beach wrestling style for women to give them another style, whereas the men have freestyle and Greco. I think right now we're looking at the IOC quota. You know, Mr. Lalovic at United World Wrestling seems to think that there are too many athletes in the Olympics overall. He's not talking about wrestling. So I think there's a lot of moving parts that need to happen for the IOC before wrestling can really sit there and look at a strategy. But Mr. Lalovic is an IOC member, which kind of helps us as a sport. And I know that he said that every sport after 2020 is going to be reevaluated. So, you know, we're looking at things, and anything that's going to help the gender equity is good. Now, the problem we run into is, and I think United World Wrestling is doing an okay job at rectifying this, is the weight classes. Okay, back in the day, there were 10 weights, both styles, but we didn't have women. Now we've got 6, 6, and 6. So we've added the women. People are blaming the women, but we're also looking at it from an whole IOC standpoint. So a lot of moving targets, a lot of blame, a lot of misfocused blame. But they're bringing back 10 weights for the World Championships. We'll know those weights after Paris this year. So I'm curious to think, is 10 weights in a World Championship not necessarily a consolation prize, but is that, in your opinion, a better use of saying, okay, three of the four years, we're going to have 10 weights in all three styles?
Well, I mean, if you ask guys that are world champions, a lot of them will say, right, that it's harder than the Olympics because you don't have to qualify the weight, so you have more competitors represented at the world championship level. So I think in terms of just, you know, internal pride and drive, that world title is just as valuable to the, you know, in some ways, at least it was earned in a level that you're the best in the world at that weight. I don't think it diminishes that, right? So that's my opinion. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm looking back at it too, and the way the weights have changed. We're talking about guys like Valentin Jordanov and Zeke Jones and their great rivalry. Their weight class doesn't exist anymore. So, and as we're seeing the weight classes shift upwards, whereas, you know, we've seen a lot of the Asian countries lose out on medals because just physiologically, they have a lot more athletes that are at those lower weights. I mean, Rob Eider's weight class doesn't exist anymore unless you're a woman. You know, he was a 48-kilo guy, and now that's the lowest weight class for the women. So what I like about the 10 weights, once they figure out what they are, one, they're trying to find an equivalency that's similar that makes all these countries happy. And of course there might be a little bit of a gamesmanship there or some trading, so to speak. Well, our guy can't make here. We need this weight class here. I think that's the question on why they move Greco up to 130 is so Mian Lopez could actually make weight for Cuba, because that man is gigantic. What I like about it is we're going to get 10. So we're going to get more of our world's greatest wrestlers representing their countries and winning world medals. And it'll make the Olympics harder because there would be tweener weights, and you've had potentially two world champions going for the same weight class in a country, say like Hungary or Bulgaria or Russia, as we know. So I like the 10. I just hope they come up with some weight classes that give every one of those 10 weight classes an opportunity to logically get to one weight or the other. So we're not pinching out good athletes. I mean, and I know that the weight class has kind of ended Kerry Kolat's career a little prematurely in terms of, you know, being at a super competitive weight. I mean, he was always a little small for 65 kilos when he was making his comeback. So I like it for the 10 weights to see we can get some of these great wrestlers that we don't get to see because now there was 7, now there's 8, soon to be 10. So I'm excited for the quality of wrestling that we can see for, you know, we've already seen it with the non-Olympic weights on the quality of wrestling with guys like Logan Stieber and James Green, for example, winning world medals for the United States.
Yeah. So you, that was great. You got an interview with Ninad, and I think it's good to know what United World Wrestling, like even like the board members, you know, what their role is, what they're doing, and kind of letting, you know, the masses kind of know what they're about, how they can get behind what the United World Wrestling is doing, and kind of, you know, having that transparency. So it kind of builds a lot more trust, right, than what was had with FILA, just by knowing them and knowing their background, who they are and what they're about and what their vision is. And I think, you know, we could, you know, help, right?
Well, yeah, one thing I think the accessibility is better because in my previous experiences with the with Mr. Lalovich's predecessor, Rafael Martinetti, were not positive. They were very terse. They were actually more, it was more of him yelling at me than it was me asking him questions. And it was at the point where I would, as a journalist, even before I worked at USA Wrestling and then during my time at USA Wrestling, I'd never want to ask the guy a question for anything because he always thinks, you know, oh, what do you care? I do not tell, you know, it was like, it was very, very rude. Now, Mr. Lalovich, I think he said hello to me every single time he sees me, which is a stark contrast. And I'm just an American media guy. So what I do like is that they are open to these the media interviews. I know that Bill May has been involved. He's a native Minnesotan, in case you were wondering, who is involved in their rankings and a lot of their PR and their press releases. And he was a guy who was kind of helping out kind of as a de facto media guy until they became United World Wrestling. And they actually brought him on officially. So, you know, Bill's been a guy who's helped us out overseas for years. And the fact that United World Wrestling identified him as a resource and kept him on versus, you know, alienating some of the people that were helping, you know, they kept the good people, which was kind of cool. So, again, that accessibility is good. When I'm over there as a journalist, or I was there doing the broadcast for the European television and the web stream, and it was their technical crew. There's, you know, we've got guys like Davidas, I don't know his last name, but he's a Lithuanian who's working with their software, and Sebastian, who's French. He does a great job. He worked the Olympics. So getting a good core of people that are competent is a huge plus. And these guys have been there for a while. But I can say that, again, that accessibility has been a plus from at least where I sit in trying to cover the sport of wrestling, not just domestically, but globally. So I know it took a little while to get the interview taken care of because they have meetings upon meetings upon meetings because this is a crucial time. They're going to decide the weight classes after Paris. They've got test events. They're looking at the 2-day weigh-in cycle. You know, the Cadet Worlds is going to be a 2-day weigh-in. We saw that with the girls at their recent junior women's world team trials in Texas, that they're on a 2-hour weigh-in, two-day format. So we're waiting to see what's going to happen with that. Actually, I think that might have been the wrong one. I think it was the cadet women that did that, but it wasn't the juniors. But yeah, point being, this is a busy time, so it's going to be, this summer is crucial for wrestling, I believe.
Yeah, and do you feel like that 2-day weigh-in, I think I was talking to Corey Jarvis in Canada, saying at the Olympics with the 1-day, if you lost on that backside, you guys had different rest cycles, right? So you'd be wrestling back-to-back matches, 15-minute rest, and you're still going, and the other guy's rested, and it can change a guy that you beat pretty solid earlier, a little different after he's got a lot of recovery, and you're just, you know, coming right after your last match. So don't you think that'll be a little bit better for just the equity for the competitors?
In theory, I think we still have to figure out what the bracketing is going to look like, because I still think they need to go beyond the semifinal losers. Or if you lose to a finalist, you're in that repechage. I think that there can be a way with the 2-day format to break that out to, if you lose to somebody who makes the semifinals, you can actually wrestle back to a full 8th place if they get rid of that second bronze medal. But then again, they like that second bronze too. So, because
you can explain why they like the second bronze medal, I don't really.
Well, my opinion is, I don't have any confirmed validation on this, but my thought is one, they only care about the gold medalist, so they want to crown a champion. Okay, great. They're not worried about going, okay, we want to know who the best 3 or 4 athletes in the world are. We want to know who the champion is, and everybody else is wrestling for medals. And if under the current format, you know, is Guinea-Bissau going to have a guy that's going to come through and have to navigate the Russian, the Iranian, the American, you know, the Hungarian just to wrestle back for a medal? Or says, okay, well, he wrestled the Russian first round, the Russians in the finals. Well, he's got to win one match to be in a medal situation, or they win a match and then they like getting the non-traditional countries to be in places to win medals, because it apparently shows off the diversity of how wrestling is a global sport, looking for African countries to win medals and Southeast Asian countries to win medals and things like that. So
it's really for the sport at the Olympic level to make it a core sport to get more representation. They feel like that helps with the IOC kind of thing.
I think more medals by more nations shows that there is a greater reach. I don't know if it's specifically for the IOC, although that seems to be a rational viewpoint. So personally, I don't like the double medal, but then again, with the 1-day format, you're you're punishing some of these losers. So, and I mean losers meaning wrestlers who've lost matches. So, as you said, right. coming through the Repechage, it's 15 minutes. I'd like to see a better consolation bracket, as we say in the United States, just so we can get a true finals and we can have the media push who the gold and silver match is going to be or the semifinals. So a lot's going to happen after these meetings after Paris. So, 2018 is going to be a year to watch because the world championship will be later in the year. They'll be in October. We'll have a longer season. I think there's going to be a gaps like 6 months continental, 6 months later, world championship. So we'll wait to see what they do with the weights and the calendar. And it's going to impact wrestling worldwide for sure.
And you feel like that later for the calendar for the worlds, will that affect viewership or attendance as opposed to earlier, like August?
It's going to affect my household, I can tell you that, because I don't have to go from Fargo to Junior Worlds to Senior Worlds to Cadet Worlds in the span of 4 weeks. So, having spacing it out, I think, is helpful because, again, we're looking at staffing, we're looking at coaches. In some of these, the nations that don't have the money, like the Russia and the United States, they got the money. But we're looking at some of these developmental coaching staffs that they have to, again, they're for a month, they could be gone. Whereas, okay, now we got one a month. Okay, 2 months later, we got this. So some of the athletes that may be junior, senior that are wrestling on both teams or coaches that are working cadet and junior teams or junior and senior teams, I think spacing it out is going to help the developmental part of it too in growing the quality of international schedule that we can produce for the cadets and juniors, which, as we know, this country lost out on with a lot of the Tour de Monde, and now we're starting to add more of the junior and cadet Pan Ams, but we need more international events for the developmental athletes versus just, okay, we're wrestling freestyle. Great. Who are we wrestling? Ourselves? How are we getting better? So I'd like to see where it develops the calendar for the junior and cadet age groups more so than the senior level.
Gotcha. So yeah, so moving on. You were at the Europeans. You want to talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I will just preface this by saying that's the first of my 5 international trips this year. So, did the broadcast for the European seniors. Then at the end of June and the start of July, I will be back in Dortmund, Germany for the European Junior Championships. So, opportunity to try to track down some of these UW Bureau members that we want to bring you here on the World Wrestling Resource. So I'll be there doing the same thing I did for the seniors. Not sure if it'll be on television there in Europe, but it'll definitely be on their web stream. Then I've got the cadet championships, actually the junior championships. So then next in Finland, followed by I'm doing the PA for the senior worlds in August. And then we go to the cadets in Greece in September. So that's my schedule. But As we look at the European Championships, I'll tell you this, John. I had never been to Serbia, never had any. The only person I knew from Serbia was Momir Pekovic and Nenad Lalovic. But it was one of the most friendly and awesome countries I've ever been to. So from an outsider standpoint coming in, not knowing what to expect, we have our electricity and our high-speed internet and our running water. We think everything's going to be so terrible outside of wherever we're at in the United States. I'll tell you what, it's the fastest internet I've ever had in a hotel outside of Las Vegas, and that was in the lobby. It was super fast there. The venue was nice. There was a mall around. There was restaurants. The food was amazing. If I lived in Serbia, I'd be 400 pounds or 200 kilos. I mean, the food is spectacular. The only drawback, I think, was the smoke, because people in Eastern Europe still typically smoke more than they do in the United States, I would assume. But that was the only negative thing was the secondhand smoke. But Novi Sad, Serbia is about an hour north of Belgrade, which is a capital. Flew in out of Minneapolis to Amsterdam to Belgrade, then got on a bus and ran into one of the Czech officials that I know, Vacev, and then Bill May. We were on the bus for about an hour, and then it was a quiet, awesome little city. The taxis were cheap. The food was amazing. The temperature was great. So from everything outside of the venue, I have high marks for. In the venue, good sight lines. A little warm in there, but got to work with John Cullen, who is a Scottish announcer who has done a lot of combat sports for the European network. So him and I got to do the broadcast. So operationally, it was 3 mats for freestyle. And then when they got the Greco the last 2 days, which is Serbia's preferred style, they had a European champion, Christian Friis. So a good crowd showed up for Greco. Again, Serbians not really the super good freestyle nation. So Sparse crowds, but good numbers on the webcast. So I know that with we looking at them, we had over 1,000 pretty much watching every stream all the time, and upwards of 2,000 and 3,000 for certain parts of the session. So honestly, that was one of the better European events I've been to in terms of how they ran it. And it's funny because I'm sitting going, yeah, this is great. And everybody's looking at me going, are you crazy? You know, because there were some internal struggles in terms of how things were set up. And, you know, from somebody who wasn't setting up an event, I didn't even notice them. So whatever issues they had weren't really noticeable from my end. So from just the setup and the travel and the location was great to me.
So you said there was like about 1,000 viewers online. How important is the viewership for like the World Championship events and Olympics for United World Wrestling to the IOC? Is that important to the IOC? Like in do the tickets sold in seats and online, does that matter to the IOC when we're talking about Olympic core sports?
I'm not sure about I know the attendance at the Olympic Games was pointed out as a reason back in 2012 after the decision came down, because they were pointing out, oh, it was at 98% capacity. I'm like, where was that other 2%? Because nobody could get tickets in London. It was crazy. But I think the tickets at like the World Championship events and the Continentals are less of an impact, because it's kind of, you know, they can look at gate receipts or whatever. Well, a lot of these international events in every sport lose money, whether they're hosted. Now, looking at the online viewership, and I was pointing out that's 1,000 per mat. They were streaming 3 different streams or 4 different streams. So one mat may have had 900 people watching. One mat may have had 1,200 people watching. You know, we're looking at, you can look at total views and go to the IOC or the sports specific and be like, look, here are our numbers. This is how many people are watching. And from to spin this on me here a little bit, in talking with T.R. Foley, who is negotiating me to come over there and working at it. And our conversation was like, because I do the PA, I also do you know, the broadcast, and the situation was, where do they use me? Where do they utilize me? And in that case, there was not a huge English speaking contingent, so they didn't need the English speaking announcer nearly as much as they would say at a world championship, where, you know, a lot more people are familiar with English and it's an official language of UWW. It's that where to utilize your resources best. In my case, it would be better for the thousands of people watching versus the 100, 200 people in the event on each day. So there's their understanding where the value of people they even bring into work is. So I think it would have been, you know, a waste of my time, honestly, to sit there and speak English to the 13 people. Actually, a lot more people in Serbia speak English than I thought. But, you know, just the presentation wise, I think it was a smart move to have me and John on the broadcast in that respect than having me sit and call matches for a crowd that, you know, English isn't their first language. So I think United World Wrestling is recognizing that. And I think the web stream is crucial for their success because, again, tangible numbers that they can show, whether it be in India for the Asian Championships, whether it be in Brazil when places don't catch on fire at the Pan Am Championships, or in Serbia for the Europeans. They had 3 Continental Championships within the span of a week, and they were all streamed. So from a wrestling fan perspective, if you like international wrestling, you definitely got a full boat of it. So, and they're it's part of their workflow. So they are really, really invested in making that work.
So you've been an announcer like at world events for United World Wrestling, and then in this one you did online. Which do you like better, announcing or kind of online announcing, where you're probably more engaged in individual match sets? Which do you prefer?
It depends. I think it depends on the environment. So I think most people listening know that I did the Olympic Games in Rio and the NCAA Championships, and I've done, you know, various broadcasts on the web for USA Wrestling and whatnot. It depends on the situation. There, it's really fun, like having the opportunity to broadcast like the Division III Championships through NCAA.com. To be able to, the people that can't make it to La Crosse or Cedar Rapids or Hershey, wherever, to be able to present them with the champions call like they would hear on television, but also the same way like in Madison Square Garden, St. Louis, to give the wrestlers and the 18,000 people in the arena a call that billows through the PA system. So it's really hard for me to basically say which one I like, because I think they both have value from a delivery standpoint, taking my own personal goals out of it. It's very hard to stay on 100% of the time doing either. But I think with the PA, you have the ability to turn that mic off and you don't worry about dead air. Sometimes the best time a PA announcer is to do something is when they don't say anything. You know, it's just let the crowd take it. And you can't really do that a whole lot with a webcast. because there are things that you have to let people know of outside of the mat area just to give them some context. So I don't know. I think I started out with the PA when I was like 14, and now I'm back at it at 37. So I think it's I like them both probably equally, but for different reasons.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, you're doing a great job with it. And your voice inspires like a lot of the youth after a while, right? They hear your voice.
I don't know about inspiring. I mean,
but they recognize that voice, right? So then they're like, they want to be a part of that. Right. So then by the time they get there, like hoping that your voice is there when they get there, because Sandy Stevens used to be that way, right?
At Fargo, she's still that way. She's still doing Fargo. Yeah. She's still doing events. I mean, it's and even to the point where I haven't seen the movie yet, but American Wrestler, and they brought her in to be the voice of the California State Tournament because that was the authenticity. She's been the voice of that tournament for 30 something years. So when they were making the movie, which was based in California, they used the actual voice of the state tournament. So there are times I know that back in Virginia when I was doing events, I'd hear that, be like, oh yeah, that guy's announcing. But I think Sandy right now is when people talk about something like recognizing the voice, that's the one you're never gonna forget. Her and the late Ed Aliberti. It's like, you know, when you walked into the Virginia Duels, a fall on two, you know, it was Ed. It was like that's the guy. So, you know, some of that, I don't know if I've done nationals 2 years and done, you know, I got the Olympic trials. I've got the world team trials coming up now in Lincoln in a couple weeks. So I don't think I'm there yet nationally. I know that people back home in Virginia will recognize it, but it's still, I've still got a lot of time left. So I'm not trying to like jump in front and be like, hey, you should hear me first. You know, I'm I'm just trying to keep my large ego humble in some respects, but it's easier said than done.
Well, yeah, it's just good for the sport, though, that consistency, right? So Monday Night Football, you'd have the announcers and Costas for the Olympics. I mean, certain guys' voices, and it can kind of build that brand and that intimacy with the fans and the commentators. So it seems good for the sport, and it's good to see that you're at the Olympics. And you want to tell people how you get selected for Olympics and then how they decide, you know, who's going to, you know, you got all these different nations speaking different languages, how you guys rotate, who's speaking what at the Olympics, how that was worked out. That's probably a lot of little kinks there.
Yeah, that could probably be a whole show on its own. But I've talked about that some on some other shows, which we were talking about before we started. But in short, a lot of people say it's all about who you know, and not necessarily that's the case. But part of it is being at the right place at the right time, combined with knowing people that you meet at those right places at the right time, and then being in a situation where you're available. Like I was talking with Rich Bender about, you know, announcing things when I was at the test event. I'll get to that in a second. I'll come back to that. But, you know, when there was an opening there, he asked if I was interested in coming back, and I said no. And it was because I could not do all this type of things if I worked for basically, you know, any 9-to-5 or a company. So taking that into consideration, you've got to be flexible enough to have the time off from work or work for yourself, like I do in my case. So met the competition manager for Rio in 2014 when I was in Uzbekistan through him and the president of the Brazilian Federation. So Brazil's Rich Bender, who I met through the Save Olympic Wrestling Movement, there were relationships forged. And I wanted to go down there and work in basically more of a broadcast webcast capacity for like NBCOlympics.com for their online stuff. I didn't know how that worked. And at the time I had already left USA Wrestling. So I knew I wasn't going to be there in their family of coverage. So like I was in London. So I was trying to work into getting any type of broadcast position. I wasn't sure how it was going to cost me. I made sure I got a credential. I applied a year and a half in advance, and then the ball started rolling. And then when we get close to it in January of 2016, they held a women's wrestling test event down in Carioca Arena 2, or Carioca 3 is where it was. I think they were going to hold the wrestling in 2, because the other one wasn't done yet. They fly me down, and I don't know until the day before that I was being put in line for the PA job, because I did not apply for the PA job because my friend Ken Berger had done it in London. So I didn't want to step on his toes. That was his world. I guess after Vegas and the Worlds, they went with me, and I went down there and announced it. And then ultimately Ken ends up working with me and doing the job I applied for. We basically switched roles on what we were looking to do for 2016. But that's the short version of, you know, they identified me. I guess they heard me at the World Championships, and like Pete Isaias gave me an opportunity, me and Ken an opportunity there. So They just, you know, as far as the names, that's a lot of research. That's not a solo job. Ken and I worked on those for, you know, 2 months leading into the World Championships, and every night going into the Olympic Games, we met, sat down in a restaurant in Brazil and said, okay, here are the names. And then we got them done. So there's a lot more to that story, but that's kind of the short version of how the Olympic thing developed.
Kind of makes you an encyclopedia of wrestling after a while. I have to do a lot of studying for announcing on these events, probably Europeans and everything, you know, we appreciate all you do, and that's why it's awesome having you at World Wrestling Resource, because you definitely know the wrestling world and the community, and we're thankful for World Wrestling Resource for you for hosting these podcasts, for sure.
Well, I'm glad the offer came out about this. This is working on our third year here on the show, and I'd like to thank Defense Soap and Guy Seiko for their support of this program and for World Wrestling Resource as a whole, because when I travel and there are people, I've talked about David Lopez down in Mexico, who is part of the International Network of Wrestling Researchers, which we talked about in a previous episode with Dr. Dave Kirby, is that he showed us, I like this show because we talk about international wrestling. And so with minds like Terry Brands and Dennis Hall, who aren't on the show with us today, but they bring a level of intensity and knowledge that I don't get every single show I do. I get that every single show I do with the World Wrestling Resource. So one, I'm thankful you guys reached out and made it one of my charter podcasts here on the Mat Talk Podcast Network.
Well, thanks for all you do, Jason. And I guess we'll call this a wrap for this podcast, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're going to set us up and close us out, but I think I'll do that. So for John McGovern and in absentia, Dennis Hall and Terry Brands, this is Jason Bryant. You've been listening to episode 42 of the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. You can go to WWRpodcast.com to subscribe to this show. Find out everything that the World Wrestling Resource has to offer with its camps, its technique systems at worldwrestlingresource.com.
Is part of the Mat Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MatTalkOnline.com.